No other single project alternative is likely to address the same Cook Inlet energy supply shortfall in a comparable time frame.
An in-state gas line report indicates production could begin by 2019. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 5th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Chicoloon residents put the brakes on coal development.
It indicates, I think, that DNR realizes that it has to take seriously public comment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
North Slope Natural Gas could be in Anchorage's future. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation today released the results of a year-long study that shows a project independent of the gas line from the slope to markets in Canada and the lower 48 that could be delivering gas to Alaska customers in 2019 at a cost only a little higher than what customers are now paying. The corporation was set up by the legislature last year. CEO Dan Foskey says the project is large, but it can be done. He says the plan shows how the standalone pipeline would deliver gas to Anchorage users at $9.63 a million BTUs. That compares to the current $8.85 price. Fairbanks's prices would fall under the plan from $23 now charged to $10.45 under the new project. Foskey says he expected the study to show costs would be much higher, and the viable price makes the project something to pursue.
Alternative project schedules. No other single project alternative is likely to address the same Cook Inlet energy supply shortfall in a comparable time frame. Gas storage and hydroelectric projects are complementary to the ASAP, or the Alaska Standalone Project. I've been asked this question 100 times. I believe the state needs all of these things. And so we're not an impediment. We're not in the way of it. We're not in the way of a GEO. We're not in the way of hydroelectric, any of these things. They complement each other. And if you look at the time schedules over time and when things are supposed to come online, you start to see that.
Foskey says he still supports continuing with work on a pipeline to North American markets as a revenue source for the states. The smaller line is something Alaska can do on its own to assure an energy source for its own residents. The plan estimates the overall cost of the project at $7.5 billion, and Foskey says the legislature should give serious consideration to owning the line, but not operating it, primarily because it would pay less to borrow the capital than it would to take to build the project.
Many have said, no, wait a minute, here we go again with the state getting involved. I never said operate, I said own. And to remind people, the state owns Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, it owns the railroad, it owns Ted Stevens, it owns ADA, it owns the permanent fund. You own a lot of really nice things. We do as a state, so I want you to keep your mind open.
Foskey says with new oil and gas discoveries recently made in Cook Inlet, there is enough gas in the system to last until the project is complete. However, predicting economic and social chaos in Anchorage and Fairbanks if those places were to go dark, he recognizes that there is no time to spare. He said getting power to 500,000 Alaskans is the goal of the line. The Chicagoff Island city of Pelican has long prided itself on being closest to the fish. Its placement in Lisianski Inlet made it an ideal spot for fishermen to drop off their catches and quickly head back out to the fishing grounds. That's how Pelican started in 1938 when Charlie Radicanen, aboard the fishing vessel Pelican, established a cold storage facility there. But that complex is now closed, and as a result, the local economy has suffered. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports on the loss of the cold storage and what it's meant for Pelican.
It's breakfast time at the Lisianski Inlet Cafe, where Victo Stepanenko is working on some corned beef hash right behind the breakfast counter. Victo and his wife Karen have run this cafe since 1987. Karen is also on the city council.
When I first moved here, there were 300 trawlers and 90 longliners that fished out of here. And there were longline seasons, like two-day openers. And we would have boats lined up, like seven boats all tied up to each other, because our harbor is so packed. And that doesn't happen anymore because longlining is every day. They set a season like from March until November.
Stepanenko is talking about IFQs, or individual fishing quotas, which federal fisheries managers adopted in the early 1990s. Instead of short openings where fishermen could catch as much halibut as possible, they're now assigned an amount of fish to catch over a several-month season.
You could now fish in, out of your home in Sitka and just take your time about catching your fish.
Norm Carson runs Pelican's Chamber of Commerce and is the town's unofficial historian.
There's no incentive to be fast anymore. All you have to do is catch what's allotted to you.
And with no need to hurry and unload and head back out, Pelican's claim of being closest to the fish suddenly became a lot less important to those doing the fishing. Carson says the IFQ system made a big impact, but wasn't the only factor in Pelican's struggle.
The market just changed so much that there was no desirability for a whole frozen salmon that had been stored for 3 months. And that hurt. The fact that it's labor intensive, fish are being moved from the first floor to the second floor to the third floor, then brought back down to the second floor to be shipped out. Just too much labor involved.
Carson would know. He worked here in the late 1960s. As we walk up to the building, we see that one of the doors is wide open, and Carson, a retired state trooper, jokes that he's in good with the local gendarmes, so we might as well take a look around. Up on the third floor, we find a darkened room where they used to store fish, and this room has seen better days.
There's water on the floor.
I can't quite see.
And the roof is separated up above. So for the last at least year and a half, all this fresh water has been seeping into this old wood, and it's bound to be rotting. But again, you don't need a plant to store 5 million pounds of fish anymore. So this is really obsolete. This room will never be full of frozen fish again. When I worked here, this entire room was nothing but stacks of frozen fish. We actually ran out of room.
On the second floor, the break room door is open. Yellowing paperbacks are still on shelves here, and a canister of sugar still sits on the counter.
It's just like the whistle blew and the crew walked out and didn't show up for the next shift.
It didn't shut down on one day. That's the trouble. It shut down stage by stage by stage. So it was not one point where it shut down.
Kathy Wasserman was mayor of Pelican from 1997 to 2004. She witnessed firsthand a lot of the cold storage's troubles. Today, she's executive director of the Alaska Municipal League in Juneau, a nonprofit that lobbies on behalf of municipal governments. And she says Pelican's issues are not unique.
Not many jobs, no industry, high unemployment, high utility prices, not good access to transportation. I mean, that's Alaska in a nutshell.
Or at least small communities in Alaska, she says. Still, Wasserman believes this town will begin growing again.
I think someday Pelican will be, and I hate to use this word, discovered by someone. The question is it going to be the way in which the majority of Pelican people that are still left there want to see it discovered? Just like half the communities will say, well, we don't want to be another Skagway with 50,000 cruise ships. However, at some point, Pelican's going to have to make a choice. Is it better to go kind of down a road that everyone's not comfortable with? Or is it best just to shut down?
Back on the boardwalk, Norm Carson says the cold storage has some life in it yet, if in a slightly different form.
There's hope. A small-scale cold storage, maybe a value-added fish processing here. Perhaps a fish hatchery down here at Pelican Creek.
You sound optimistic about a lot of the things around here.
Well, why not? I mean, just take a look at the country. It's a beautiful place to live, and Why wouldn't you want to be here?
Reporting from Pelican, I'm Ed Ronco.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans try to figure out why racing Mount Marathon seems like a good idea.
What's going through my mind is, why am I doing this again?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com. The State Department of Natural Resources has withdrawn a decision allowing a coal mine project to go forward near Sutton. On July 1st, DNR announced that it would not allow Ranger Alaska, an Australian-owned mining company, to develop a surface strip mine and an underground coal mine at Jonesboro. Castle Mountain Coalition spokesman Kirby Spangler says it's a win for local residents who are opposed to coal development.
It's a procedural victory was the way it was kind of described to me, in that we got DNR to withdraw the permit, and they now have to address some of our comments that they did not address when they renewed the Jonesville mine permit. So they have to go back and address that comment, and then we can challenge them on a substantive issue.
Castle Mountain Coalition, Chickaloon Village Tribal Council, and other groups have been outspoken against the coal development in the area. A number of coal projects near Chickaloon and Sutton have sparked opposition based on environmental concerns regarding salmon habitat, air and water pollution, and proximity to land considered sacred by Alaska Natives.
Well, I think it's great news. It indicates, I think, that DNR realizes that it has to take seriously public comment on these permits, and that it can't just rubber stamp permits that are based on, you know, outdated and faulty information.
Appeals against the coal permit focused on DNR's failure to respond to public comments and its failure to require mine owners to meet statutory deadlines. Jeffrey Stauffer, an attorney representing the Chickaloon Village Tribal Council, says the matter is in DNR's hands now. Stauffer says Ranger Alaska needs to file a whole new permit. Backyard chicken keeping is gaining momentum in Anchorage. That's largely due to an assembly ordinance that passed back in April. Now that chicken owners can be more open about their lifestyle choice, we can get a peek into what it's like to raise poultry in an urban environment, or at least as urban as it gets in Alaska. APRN's Heather Arono has the story.
I'm in Peggy Wilcox and Teo Graber's backyard in downtown Anchorage. I'm standing in front of what is called a chicken tractor, a small chicken coop with wheels for easy mobility. To Teo, it's not just a coop, it's a lovingly constructed masterpiece. The windows have custom-made trim, and the roosting box is easily cleaned because of the drawer that Teo installed. Now it's time for a treat, a mix of seeds and barley called chicken scratch that the birds love to eat. Peggy and Teo have had their chickens for 2 months now. They decided to embrace the chicken-keeping lifestyle after the Anchorage Assembly passed an ordinance allowing residents to keep up to 5 chickens.
And it was just something, because we could do it after the Assembly passed the ordinance, when they were talking about passing the ordinance, it's like, wow, I bet it'd be fun to have chickens. Because we'd try to buy local eggs, and they weren't always available at Nusagaya or at Alaska Mill and Feed, and we didn't feel like driving to the valley. So we were talking about it once the Assembly started talking about it, and then as soon as they passed it, Teo built this great chicken tractor. And we went and got some chickens, and it's actually been really, really fun.
Originally put off at the thought of naming chickens that they might end up eating, they found a compromise.
We didn't know what to name the chickens. We were a little nervous about naming them because we were afraid that eventually we wouldn't end up eating them. So we named them after food. The white one was the spunkiest one when they got here, so she became the General Zhao. And then the three golden comets are stewed, fried, and baked.
And you can tell them apart fairly easily?
No, they're kind of collectively stewed, fried, and baked. If we spent more time with them, I'm sure we could tell them apart, but we don't so much. We just refer to them generally as chickens.
They like their chickens so much that they want to keep an eye on their coop, even away from the house.
We have a chicken cam. It is a remote camera, so we can actually watch them from inside or listen to them, make sure the dog's not going after them.
With so many Alaskans like Peggy and Teo who want to keep chickens, the UAF Cooperative Extension Service holds workshops called Chicken University. Stephen Brown teaches the workshops around Alaska. He covers how to house and care for chickens properly, which can be more complicated than a lot of people think.
The big thing is making sure people know what they're getting into, because it's more than just buying a bird.
But he says people shouldn't let the potential startup costs intimidate them.
We jokingly like to say that any good Alaskan has enough stuff in their front yard to properly keep chickens if you're clever enough.
Brown got started teaching the Chicken University workshop when he noticed an increased interest in raising chickens in Alaska. But he also noticed that a lot of people didn't have much information to start with, and some were being taken advantage of.
What really triggered my most recent interest is we saw where guaranteed laying hens were being advertised for $100, and people were buying them.
Certain varieties of chicken can run into the hundreds, but it's more common to find laying hens available for $15 to $20, or even for free. Brown says people choose to raise chickens for a variety of reasons.
People realize that in Alaska, we're at the end of the food chain, and if something interrupts that, we're in trouble. So keeping chickens is a way of having food security. Another reason is people want to know where their food is coming from.
Brown says that while there has been a definite increased interest in raising chickens in Anchorage, not much has changed since the ordinance passed 2 months ago.
I haven't seen a big increase since that ordinance went through, which kind of tells me that people that wanted to keep chickens were already keeping chickens.
While Peggy and Teo did wait until it was legal to keep their chickens, they don't see a reason for people to wait anymore.
It's what, 10, 15 square feet? It's what, 4 feet tall? Takes up very little room. It's fun. You get to have chickens around, and you get fresh eggs. There's really no downside that we've seen.
For APRN, this is Heather Arono.
Stephen Brown will be teaching his Chicken University workshop tonight at 7 at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage as part of their Summer Nights at the Zoo series. And you can keep an eye on Peggy and Teo's chickens by going to chickenbungalow.com. APRN will also have a link on the alaskapublic.org site. A likeness of Alaska's most famous former governor has become a popular target for thieves in Juneau. A high-quality wooden cutout of Sarah Palin wearing fishing gear and holding a salmon has been stolen twice from the Alaska Shirt Company store on South Franklin Street. The most recent theft happened over the weekend. The prop usually sits on the front steps during business hours, and store manager Darren Bouton says it's a hit with tourists.
Some people love her and some people don't. So it just changes. I mean, it just depends on what people's personal opinions are that come up. Some people want a picture with her. Some people just kind of laugh and walk by. It's just for entertainment.
Juneau police were able to recover the cutout, valued at $1,400, from a parked vehicle in the Mendenhall Valley. It's currently stashed in an evidence locker while officers investigate the theft. The real Palin was spotted in Iowa last week at the premiere of a flattering documentary about her 2.5-year tenure as governor.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
at the 84th running of the Mount Marathon race in Seward yesterday. Runners from Anchorage placed in the top two spots for men and women. Eric Strable came in about 20 seconds ahead of Brent Knight. In the ladies' race, Keegan Randall came in about 20 seconds before Holly Brooks. But the race was full of runners who weren't expecting to win and instead wanted to push their limits mentally and physically. KDLL's Ben Stanton has this profile of two of those racers.
All morning it's been cloudy in Seward, but not raining, so people that run this race say that's ideal conditions for the race. A relatively dry trail, nice temperature, no blazing sun. That'll change a little later, but late in the morning, a big crowd of spectators are starting to congregate near the banner marking the starting point where long blue carpets are laying across 4th Avenue. As the women's race approaches, more and more ladies in the crowd look like runners, not just because they're wearing bibs with numbers, but because they just look like they could be mountain runners, like 55-year-old Cheryl Maline from Wasilla.
I want to get going. That's it. I just want to, once I'm going, I'm fine. And the hardest part for me is running to the mountain. The run to the mountain, I find it very difficult. The road seems very steep. I don't know why, but it does.
Maline says she's not intimidated by the sight of the mountain looming overhead and the more than 3-mile round trip and more than 3,000-foot ascent for a tall view of Seward and Resurrection Bay.
And I'm scared of heights.
But somehow that doesn't bother Maline. But the mental aspect for her?
My mental is, why am I doing this? And then on the way down, it's so much fun that I remember.
The dirt trail leads to a rocky top, and some runners say it's tough to take a few steps just to slide back down a bit.
Well, you just keep trucking. That's all you can do, say one step at a time.
Maline says she cannot quite remember what prompted her to first run 14 years ago, but she does remember previously seeing Mount Marathon racers and thinking, well, they're maniacs.
That's right, and I've been a maniac for 14 years. I thought it was only like 9, and I was on the computer, it was like 14. I'm like, there you go.
The ladies' race got underway, and as they're starting to return, 54-year-old Dan Canetta from Kenai has arrived to prepare for the men's race in a few hours. He says he'd really like to finish under 1 hour 30 minutes.
That's my personal goal. I certainly can't keep up with the top place guys, but they sure are impressive.
Canetta has been running this race since 1994.
What's going through my mind is, why am I doing this again?
Besides his personal time goal, Canetta says avoiding injury is also high on the list, and he does have a plan and preferred route and method. He likes to take the traditional trail going up and normally starts the descent with a snow slide.
And then I get in the soft shale coming down that, and then basically go down the chute, and hit the base of the mountain, and try to sprint to the finish line if I got anything left.
He says it can be tough to find that energy at the end.
And the crowd plays a big part of that in getting you psyched up about just making it to the finish line, and you feel like you don't want to let the crowd down, so you just do your best.
Both the separate men's and women's races got underway with a starting pistol. After the runners leave, the crowd mills around with binoculars and telescopes, watching tiny dots trickle up and then fly back down the mountain. The last few blocks before the end, runners have a long, gentle slope for a change as the road approaches the water. The top ladies' finishers come in, and about 45 minutes later, Cheryl Maline finishes just a hair over 1 hour 37 minutes.
It was a great finish! Is it the bottom number? I always get mixed up.
There's a little confusion about her timing because there are two clocks for each of the waves of runners. As runners finish, they get a bottle of water, they get sprayed down with a hose, maybe eat an orange or banana, but Maline was the only one I saw that gets handed a dozen red roses.
Oh, thank you!
Hey, all right.
Huh? Wait, is this from my students?
From your students?
Oh, my God.
Maline teaches certified nurse assistant students.
My students love me. They're down here cheering me on.
Apparently they do, and her supporters quickly surround her and go off to take pictures. Later in the day, the men's race, also about 45 minutes after the leaders, Canetta crosses the finish line to take a few minutes, crouched over with a bottle of water, recovering before saying,
"The pack was setting a pretty good pace for me. It was all I could do to keep up, and so they pushed me pretty hard."
Finished in about an hour and 32 minutes. He says because that snow slide was not at the top, he thinks he fell a little short of his goal.
There was no snow slide, so that slowed me down a little bit, but overall, I'm happy with my time. A little more than I want it to be, but there's always next year.
Yeah, there's always next year. Canetta is an optimist, but as it turns out, he's also wrong. Canetta was looking at the wrong clock, and the official time posted the next day shows 5 minutes off that time for 1 hour 27 minutes, a few minutes under his personal goal. So congratulations, Dan. You did it. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
When Keegan Randall won Mount Marathon for the first time yesterday, her mom, Deborah, was there to celebrate. Deborah is a past Mount Marathon champion herself, and she was probably the only person collecting condolences over Keegan's win. That's because she's held her own Mount Marathon victory over Keegan's head through the years.
Well, as she starts getting all these accomplishments, I mean, what do you do? It's like, Keegan, geez, you've got world championships, you've been to the Olympics, there's got to be something you don't have. Ah, yes, and, when you're in Alaska, that Mount Marathon is kind of a sacred event. It's like, that's really something to put in your crown, is to win that race.
Deborah says she didn't have high expectations for her daughter before yesterday's race because Keegan has been so focused on ski racing this year, but she was absolutely thrilled when she won.
And of course, she's all smiles and, getting congratulations from everybody. And, I'm just almost cheerful thinking about it because it was really exciting. It was very, very fun, and my whole family was there. It was great that everybody could be there to see it because, when one of those things happens, you want to be there. You don't want to read about the newspaper.
Winning the race runs in the family. Deborah's sister, Betsy Haynes, won 3 Mount Marathons in a row in the late 70s and early 80s. Deborah's own win came before Keegan was born.
1975, which is almost going to be 40 years ago if I, in another 5 or 6 years, and I'm like, they're trying to get me to do it again, and I'm not going to do it again. That mountain scares the bejesus out of me.
And as for whether she was a little bit sad to see Keegan take away the one sports endeavor she could brag about besting her daughter in, not a chance.
And, everybody was coming up to me and giving me condolences because now I have nothing to hold over her. But I pointed out, I said, wait a second, she's only tied me because I'm a prior winner. Now, if she wants to beat me, she's going to have to win 2.
Deborah says she's very happy being a spectator these days. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Pelican, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Ben Stanton in Seward. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Heather Arono from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our radio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.